By that time, were you particularly enamored of the San Diego area and wanting to...
I liked the San Diego area, but it wasn't, again, it wasn't a search to stay in San Diego. That, as I say, I would have gone to Michigan, Ann Arbor is a nice place, the department was a good department, there were good people there to work with, there would have been people to talk with, so that I wasn't worried about leaving San Diego. It wasn't particularly that I was enamored of San Diego. I like it here. That's not to say that I don't like it here, but that wasn't the choice to stay here was that this was a good department, a good place to do science, that good colleagues who could actually, although not doing what I'm doing exactly, would be helpful in talking to things but that I wanted to do. And that's all been true. This has been an excellent place to do science, a good place to get started.
What kind of startup support did you get?
The Institute knows that you're here to do science. So when you start out, they tell you, first of all, if you walk through the building, you realize that all the heavy equipment is held in common. So it's not necessary to buy lots and lots of heavy equipment. So that while I was interviewing, Ron Evans said, Walter Eckhart, who's the chairman of what passes for my department, Ron said, Walter will tell you that we're not going to give you a specific dollar amount, just order whatever you want. And then Ron said, he really means it. Then I went and talked to Walter, and Walter said, well, we don't usually give people a specific dollar amount on startup money, we just tell you to order whatever you want. And I ordered whatever I wanted when I took the job, and didn't worry about it. I don't think I was particular. It wasn't an ego thing to me to say, I can order so much, and I'm going to order the most expensive this and the most expensive that, and I'm going to tell my friends I spent $500,000 and they only spent $250,000. That wasn't important to me. I think it is important to some people. But I ordered what I needed. I got everything I wanted. I didn't feel that I was being slighted in the least in setup. And so I have no idea how much I actually spent in setup. They paid my salary until I had... The Institute found money one way or another to pay my salary and hire a technician until run my lab until grants came through. And that's basically how it works here. Although it's a soft money institution, basically, one signs a contract. That contract guarantees you a salary for the period of the contract, whether or not you get a grant, although your grant's expected to pay for your salary if you have one. And the general philosophy is you're here to do science. You're not helping anybody if you have no grant and no money to do anything. So they try to keep all the laboratories running, even in times of tight funding. Now, particularly tight funding times, probably decisions going to have to be made about how different programs, at least that are unfunded, how much we're going to be able to keep the laboratories running. How large a lab can someone whose grants have fallen through continue to run? But I think that the real idea would be that they will continue to run, try to keep everybody at least doing something.
How large a lab do you have?
Pretty small right now. 3 postdocs and a technician that I've had that's gone up and down in size, that had some people, various different visitors at different times. I had 2 technicians for a while. One of them left, and I haven't replaced him.
What is your workload? How much time do you spend in the different things that you have to do?
Most of the time is spent doing science one way or another, although there's some administrative load that I now have, that the Institute has become, used to be a fairly strong autocracy. Now there's a larger component of faculty input, so that there's at least some committee work that I have to do to sort of determine the policies that the Institute will have in the future. How does X, Y, or Z work? So that takes some time, but not an enormous amount. Most of it spent in one aspect of science or another, writing papers, working in the lab, reviewing other people's papers, those kinds of things.
Can you break down an average day or an average week in terms of how much time you spend?
Probably not. I don't really keep a time clock that way, so I haven't... I do what has to be done on a given day. So some weeks I work like a postdoc, and some weeks I work like an administrator.
How many hours a week do you put in
typically? Honestly, probably somewhere really between 40 and 45. I'm not one of the 80-hour-a-week types.
Do you come in on Saturday and Sunday or not?
Quite often. That it's one of the things that comes with the job, that If I come in on Saturday or Sunday, it's because I have a very specific thing I have to get done. That I want to do this today so I can do this tomorrow so I can do this thing on Monday. So I will do things like that, or come back at night. I have this thing that's at this point has to come back and be done. But so no, I come in Saturdays and Sundays, but not just there. I think that there are some people, it's really my belief, there are some people who come in to be in. And I can't prove that, but I've seen people who spend thousands of hours in the lab a week. Many of those hours are doing things they could have done at home. Most people, it's difficult to organize your day so you have 12 productive hours a day. And I haven't ever been productive working that way. Didn't work that way as an undergraduate, as a graduate. You do what works for you. You find a rhythm that works for you, and that's always I've had about the same rhythm all the way through.
Have you felt peer pressure to be more in the lab than you are?
I think as a postdoc, I felt some of that. Sometimes you feel that sort of peer pressure, but there certainly is the feeling. But I've always preferred to think about whether I was getting anything done or not, rather than whether to some extent, spending a lot of, again, you watch the people who spend a lot of hours in the lab, they aren't necessarily productive hours. And so I've basically ignored that. That you know what, that if you don't know what works for you, then you have a problem. And this, it works for me to work reasonable, at some reasonable pace. And I can think about what I'm doing without being here. To some extent, it's not necessarily sitting here doing the experiments that's as important as thinking about the right ones. So that, at least that has worked for me so far. Maybe one needs to spend thousands of hours here. The other thing, some of the time that I might spend in the lab, that if I'm writing, I can write at home. So that there are times when I've been doing a lot of writing where I would write at home in the evenings rather than coming back.
Can you just say something about your wife? Background?
Okay, my wife was a undergraduate at UCSD. In fact, I met her while I was a graduate student. She was a mathematics major. She taught math in school for a couple of years. Then when we have two older children, we have twin 7-year-olds now. So that when the kids were born, the headmaster at her school essentially made it as difficult as possible for her to work. And so she said, okay, I'll tutor. She had been tutoring math outside. And so now she tutors math about somewhere between 15 and 20 hours a week to the mathematically disadvantaged of La Jolla, which means that she can charge them a reasonable rate and probably makes more money in less time than she would actually teaching in the school she'd been teaching in before with none of the administrative headaches.
What other things do you do with the time when you're not here? You still maintain a strong interest in music?
No, I think that my interest in music really was never as strong. I enjoyed playing. I played in bands from the time I was in fourth grade, and I enjoyed doing it all along. It was totally recreational. It wasn't that I had a. I don't have a real bent for music. I'm okay at it. I can read music, but I really have a tin ear. I don't sing very well. So I play music like a scientist. I'm not Mark Ptasny or Mark Montminy or great musicians. I can read the notes and play them more or less. But I enjoy it. It was a fun thing to do in high school. You're part of the. It's a group of people that are totally different from scientists. So you play in the band in high school. You play in the band in college. You're doing something different. It's fun. You're out with your friends doing something that's totally different. And wasn't academics at all. It was something you did for fun. So that not a really strong interest in music. Most of the time that fairly busy just around the house and with if you buy Southern California real estate, you don't have a lot of disposable income left. So spend time working around the house and time with my kids. So that's a fair amount of it. Coach my son's little league team this year. So that there are, one certainly is busy, but it's not, one would be busy anyway, I think. I think that, I don't spend a lot of, that one isn't working doesn't mean one's not busy. But I think that's, some people are busy and some people aren't. I think that we spend a fair amount of time doing something.
Is this where you think you want to stay long term?
I like it here. There's some disadvantages to the place that may or may not be important in the long term. With the federal funding situation becoming so unreliable, even having done good and productive science is no guarantee that you will continue to be funded, makes a place that's totally soft money less and less attractive over the long term. And the lack of graduate students here, I think, is going to be a difficult problem and is a potential problem in the future. That graduate students add a different dimension to a lab program than postdocs. And you need the right mix, and there aren't many graduate students here. So those
Do
are the
you
sources.
Have an adjunct appointment? That would
no,
allow
I don't
you?
Have an adjunct appointment that would allow me to have them.
What do graduate students bring?
Well, graduate students, one, bring a certain amount of youthful energy. But postdocs are a little bit more serious and a little bit more staid. I think that they tend, in general, not to really... They're fixed in their ways, and they're, this is my project, I'm going to work on it. Now, the best ones don't necessarily do that, but a large fraction of them do. This is my project, I'm going to work on this. This is what I have to do to get done, instead of thinking about big problems. Whereas graduate students can think silly thoughts, which is important. But part of the thing is that you have... If you set up a laboratory in which you can't be wrong, you can't say something silly, you've made a mistake. Because you have to be able to really have all the ideas out there. And graduate students are more likely to say silly things, less likely in many ways to be cowed by what you think, or more willing to... They also can take on long-term projects. That there are more projects they can take on that may have a longer term or more interesting ways of getting off into different fields in a way that you can't necessarily. That postdocs, again, want something that they're pretty sure is going to work. Whereas graduate students, it may work, but it's something new, and they know that there may be some time. That period while they're learning, the 2 years when most graduate students are unproductive, they'll still have a chance to figure out what's not working. And then be off and getting something else to work. And so you don't necessarily have that with postdocs. Actually, I have a graduate student that's working about half-time with me, and then he's officially Ron Evans' graduate student, but he's doing a steroid receptor-type project in flies. So he's doing all his fly pushing in my lab. And so we spend a fair amount of time talking. So that actually is an interesting alternative project going on. Sort of fun to talk about and something else to think about. Somebody who needs a certain amount of training but likes it, he really picks it up very quickly, so it's sort of fun that way.
If you're thinking of moving, can you specify where you'd like to go or what?
Well, with regard to, say, the 2 points I specifically made, one would be talking about a university rather than a research institution. For the specific reasons that, one, they have, it isn't merely, and let's go back, it isn't merely a one wants this guaranteed salary sitting out there. It's that in a place like the SOC, one's grants are huge because your entire salary is part of the grant. So that my grant looks bigger than the competing grant from somebody else, which means that we have to run almost entirely on NIH grants. Alternative sources of funding really are not enough to fund the kinds of projects we need to do here. So NIH is the major source of funding because of the huge salary burden. And so the grants look bigger because of the huge salary burden. Even NIH grants look bigger because of the huge salary burden. Grants to things like NSF, because we have to put a fair amount of salary on them, we rapidly overcome the limit on how big an NSF grant really is going to be. So that if you're in a university setting, all these other sources of funding, say you can run a lab on an NSF grant in a university setting, because most of the money from that can go into equipment and supplies and say technician salary, whereas you can't run a lab on an NSF grant here.
But SOC has always had these problems.
SOC has always had these problems, but I think that they're worse now, that the problems become worse the tighter money gets. If grants are harder and harder to get, and they're saying, if we're having to decide between the 10th percentile grant and the 11th percentile grant, that means that you're deciding on a whole different set of factors than we were trying to decide between the 35th percentile and the 36th percentile. That it becomes a lot more, you're down, you can have a very good grant and still not be funded for reasons that you can't be sure what they are. And so it's harder and harder, these problems become greater. Every little thing that hurts your chances is magnified, I think, into this situation. So some of those problems are still the same. And then the other thing, NIH is then looking for ways to make its dollars go farther. And so it's going to start cutting more and more salary out of grant, that trying to get more to actually pay for less and less of the science it wants to buy. And so the way you do that is to say, well, somebody else has to pay the salaries. But the actual real cost of science is the cost of the time of the people doing it, as I was taught a long time ago. And NIH doesn't want to pay that, really. So they want to stick it to the universities. And so that would be a reason to go again to a university, to have the salary off the grants and the access to graduate students. But I haven't made any motions to move, so that this is not a statement that I'm trying to leave here, because I like that this has been a very nice place to do science.
What are the other negatives of the world you're in?
I mean, of being a scientist, other than no, I think there's a fair amount of competition. That's true in all fields, really. I think the major negative right now is I think that everyone's aware of the funding situation. It's this huge negative hanging over everyone that just gives you a very that. People wonder, well, why aren't people going? We have this punitive PhD shortage we're going to have in the future. Oh, we're running out of PhDs. There won't be enough PhDs. And what can we do to make more PhDs? Maybe we need better programs in the high schools. And to some extent, my view is, no, it's a totally rational decision. Why would anyone but an idiot get a PhD? And in a situation where you know that there are not necessarily that many good jobs for a PhD, and if you do get a PhD, that the chances of you being funded are 1 in 10, why would you do this? You can't. NIH has cut postdoc funding to practically zero, so the number of potential postdocs after you have your PhD is practically nil. The number of university slots is small, and the chance of getting funded if you're lucky enough to get a job is small. Why would you do this?
Have these things actually affected your science?
Well, I actually had a period of about 6 months recently where, in fact, my NIH grant wasn't funded in the first round. I was, 17th percentile, something like that. Well, actually, I wasn't. I was in the 21st percentile and the reason for, say, that rating is reading my review was people, in fact, weren't sure that I was going to be able to get the reagents I needed to do the experiments I wanted to do from, say, Bruce, when, in fact, I already had the reagents in my hands. That one, I had got them amicably from Bruce, and two, if I hadn't, they were easy enough that all the knowledge was public domain and would have taken me just a couple of weeks to get on my own. But I said, it's not clear who's going to be able to get these things from Baker. Well, this was total nonsense, but it was enough to push me from, say, 13 or 14 probably, which would have been funded, to 21, which, and what made it particularly frustrating was when I first found out my number, I called NIH and said, where are you going to fund? And they said, well, probably mid-20s. I took mean 25. And then watched it just fall from 25 to 17. So as you know, the year goes by, well, no, well, maybe not, maybe not, maybe not, maybe not. And so it's very strange. I was being invited to speak at Gordon conferences and all kinds of things that say, this person's doing good science and we really appreciate it. And watching NIH say, well, sorry, that call up your grant manager and she says, oh yeah, you know, we really think it's a very good score, you're doing great stuff. Am I getting money? No. So spent that period, lost a postdoc I wanted very much to carry on a project we were very interested in, but he was worried about the lab funding situation and ended up going elsewhere. That he'd committed to coming and then ended up going elsewhere where the guy could guarantee him funding. And so I spent a fair amount of time getting this guy funding here, but he was worried about the lab funding, and in the course of that time, he'd look for another job and left. Spent a fair amount of my time writing another grant because of it, and just the general worry about it. I think that really productivity was hurt despite this down period. The next round of grants was, I got a very good score, it was the 7th percentile, so I'm now funded again from NIH. But that was that period of time, those 9 months, was time that I wasn't as productive as I could have been.
The thought that you wouldn't get the reagents, is that sort of business pretty common?
No, that was a criticism, I think, that was, this can happen, but this was a situation where it wasn't going to happen for a couple of reasons, one of which is that they're all in the public domain, in the sense of published in journals, which as a condition of publication, you agree that you were going to pass them out. And second, that there was some concern about that, but it was a kind of concern that someone who, that in other fields, that in other fields, people will write to you for the clones to do exactly the experiment. But there's essentially it was saying, will this guy be too much of a gentleman? If Bruce doesn't want to give him the reagents, will be too much of a gentleman to be a jerk about it and just clone it out. I work in a floor with people who work on FOS-June interactions, where people call up and ask you on the phone to send the reagents so they can do the experiment you're trying to do today. We want to do this experiment. Well, we're doing that now. So do we. Send it to us. And so it was a very strange, it seemed a very strange sort of criticism, but it was enough to, it was the only clearly stated thing through the whole thing. It was just a very strange experience that way to have them.
What would you like to be doing 10 years from now, and what do you think you actually will be doing?
I don't really have a good answer for either of those. Whether or not one, say, leaves Drosophila at this point, when does one say, well, Drosophila's used up, what we can get from Drosophila's used up, and we now start working on other systems to find out what we want to know. And I'm not sure about that, whether one starts thinking about different kinds of vertebrate systems that might offer some of the advantages of Drosophila, or whether one goes directly to something like mice, which don't necessarily offer the advantages, but we can hope that by what we know from Drosophila, we can think about how to apply it intelligently to mice. I don't know. So I don't know whether we're going to do something like that, or we'll do...
Will you still want to be at the bench?
I like being at the bench. That I must admit that one of the nice things, we asked if I come in on weekends, one of the nice things about coming in on nights and weekends is you come in to be at the bench. You come in to do something. You don't come in to go to a meeting. You don't come in to meet with a postdoc or to talk about somebody else's data. You come in to do something. You come in to actually be there working on your own project. And so I think there is a certain amount of being at the bench that I think is good. And at least in my hands, when I'm working at the bench, I have a better feeling for what other people are doing. If I'm just sitting in my office, first of all, you forget how often experiments fail. If I'm working at the bench, I remember, oh yes, things can fail for me too. If you're sitting in your office, it's all too easy to say, you must be incompetent. That never happens to me. But if you're sitting at the bench, if you're working at the bench, you actually have some sense of really what's going on. I think, I guess Bruce has finally stopped working. He had a reagent discarding ceremony at some point, he told me, that he had finally given up his lab bench and thrown all his reagents away. But Rick Vertow still works at the bench, so still has things going on. One of the nice things, if you're working at the bench yourself, it keeps you current with the techniques. Because you have to keep, you can't just keep doing all the old things you used to do. You have to keep doing the new techniques that people are doing, because that's what needs to be done in the lab. So it does keep you more current on how the techniques work and where they can go wrong. And it also gives you a chance of saying, this guy's having trouble with this project. Is there something I can do to help that along? To sort of fill in that these are things. Gee, can we move this along? Maybe can I help you out by doing this? And it's a way that you can do things. So at least now I still enjoy working at the bench, and I don't have any plans to give it up and sit in my office all day. I didn't become a scientist to become an administrator.
Does it take a special effort to keep things from growing to the point where you can't stay at the bench?
Well, when one's writing too many grants, this past fall, between writing grants and I wrote a review on alternative splicing, that made it very difficult to keep at the bench. I was not at the bench for much of the fall between grant writing and writing this review, which sort of grew out of hand. It really was not possible for me to keep track of everything, that to keep working at the bench then. But as soon as that was over, I really was able to get back, and I really, at the moment, I'm spending a fair amount of my time actually concerned with doing bench science. And remember that the reason we're in this is that when you're the administrator, that was one of the things I noticed when I became a principal investigator, had people working for me. If you're the only guy working at the bench, on any given day, things either work or they don't. So you have good days and bad days. When you become a PI, you've got people working for you, on any given day, the chance of something working goes up noticeably. But the chance of not, that so that on any given day you have a good chance that something will have worked. But on the other hand, just about every given day is guaranteed to have a failure in it. So you spend a lot more time worrying about why didn't this work. And being at the bench still means that you have that thrill of, yes, this worked. I thought about it, I thought about how to do it, and it worked. It may be trivial, it may seem trivial, but it worked. I did it. And it keeps you sort of connected. It's nice. I like to push flies some, just because that means that, again, you're connected to your organism. There's something you can be doing to really get you busy doing that.
What are the central biological questions that you think about when you have a chance to sit back and think about where things are going?
I think that we still have an awful lot to learn just about general regulation of differentiation. And I think that we're going to get more and more. Other people want this room at 10:30. The people are starting to pile up outside. We can just go sit on the bench outside. Right. That's okay with you.
Well, we need a power source. That's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
But in the next, we know an awful lot about genes that control, in some sense, large structure differentiation. So this alpha, we know the cascade that controls sex differentiation, or we know some general knowledge about how you set up the anterior-posterior gradient, or how you define segment identity. But we still haven't managed to get from those hierarchies of interacting genes to how you make a particular structure. And so I'm not sure, I think that we're going to get there, but I think that's one of the directions things are going to go, that we have to be thinking about in the future. How do we actually get them closer and closer to morphogenesis? Not really. And we have large-scale control genes in place, but how do we get down to morphogenesis? And so there are different approaches to that different people are taking, some of which. And at this point, it's not possible to know what's going to work. This is something that, in my mind, is difficult to explain to the public, but I think is critical that maybe scientists start doing it. And that's that just because you know the problem you want the answer to doesn't mean you know how. Knowing the problem you want the answer to doesn't mean that that's where you should put your effort. But Roger Brandt first described it to me as something he learned in graduate school, that there are problems for which it's premature to put, into which it's premature to put your effort. And so in the, many of the scientists, many of the people in the public know their problems that they want to know about. They want to cure cancer, they want to cure AIDS, they're interested in this disease or that disease. But, and so the natural tendency is to say we should put all our money into specific studies of this disease. Now maybe it's no longer premature to do that, but for at least a long time, it was money spent on studying specific diseases was by and large wasted, because we couldn't, the knowledge we were doing, we didn't know what knowledge we needed to know. And so that now we still don't know what knowledge we necessarily need to know, but the discoveries that are going to be the key things that will actually tell us what we need or want to know are coming from, will come from areas we don't necessarily expect them to come from. So, for example, there's a biotechnology industry, not because someone 20 years ago said, gee, we need a biotechnology industry, but because somebody 20 years ago said, why is it that I can't plate lambda on E. coli B? And that I get 1 in 1,000 is the number of plaques I should get, but then in the next generation I get the right number. This seems this has nothing to do with biotechnology, you say, but that's the sort of result that eventually was the key to having a biotechnology industry at all. And no one would have done that. Those experiments were funded because someone was doing a crazy experiment, not because someone was doing what he wanted to do. It wasn't stupid what he wanted to do, but it wasn't necessarily immediately applicable to anything.